Pope John Paul II, who succeeded John Paul I, whose death has never been properly investigated, in my opinion. Pope John Paul I was going to sever the connection between the Vatican and the P2 Lodge and was moving in the direction of investigating some of the shenanigans that Vatican finances were, that the Vatican financial structure was engaging in. He was unfortunately not Pope for very long. He died in a rather strange fashion, and his death has never, in my opinion, been properly investigated. He was succeeded by Pope John Paul II. The first Polish pope, an individual who was a hardcore cold warrior, an individual who maintained the rather cozy relations between the Vatican and the P2, and who brought in none other than Hermann Abs, chairman emeritus of the Deutsche Bank and one of the most significant financiers of Nazi Germany, to help straighten out, and that belongs in quotes, the Vatican financial scandals that erupted into public view following the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano in 1982. Hermann Abs we dealt with in Radio Free America number 18. We came back to him in number 21. As I said, one of the most important Nazi financiers, a prominent backer of Adolf Hitler. Even an officer of the Deutsche Bank, upon learning that Hermann Abs had been appointed by the Pope to help straighten out the Vatican finances, observed that, quote, the Pope has made the goat his gardener. The Pope has been visiting Croatia, and in numerous broadcasts, including and especially Radio Free America program number 36, The Destabilization of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, we took a look at the persistence, at the political survival of the Croatian fascists who comprised the wartime collaborationist government, wartime fascist collaborationist government of the Ustashi during World War II. During World War II, Croatia was a puppet state of Nazi Germany. The brutal fascists that governed that puppet state, the Ustashi, were so enthusiastic and so extravagant in their extermination programs, they even horrified the SS. The bitter memories of the Ustashi massacre programs are one of the things that fueled the almost equally brutal Serbian response when once again Yugoslavia dissolved and once again Croatia not only became independent, perhaps that belongs in quotes, but significant elements of the old World War II Ustashi emerged back into full view in the, quote, independent Croatia, which adopted the currency, the flag, and even reappointed some of the old officials from the Ustashi regime. And Ustashi and some of their Nazi and fascist allies figure prominently in the new government of Franjo Tudjman, up until recently a Holocaust denier. The awareness and the bitter historical memory of the Ustashi slaughter is one of the things that fueled the bitter reaction by the Serbs, which has led to the tragic slaughter in the civil war in the former Yugoslavia. Well, the Pope, far from pouring oil on troubled waters, returned to Croatia and, in my opinion, engaged in some activities which can only make things worse in that already very troubled part of the world. Reading now from the San Francisco Sunday Examiner from today, Sunday, September 11th of 1994. This is an article by William D. Montalbano of the Los Angeles Times. It's dateline Zagreb, Croatia. It's headlined, Pope in Croatia, quote, sacred duty, unquote, to make peace, subheaded, John Paul II, unable to kiss the earth, but Balkans faithful hear his message. And skipping down in this article, we're going to take a look at another example of the historical obfuscation of fascism and the obfuscation of the profound connections between the Vatican and fascism. By the way, we dealt with the close connections between the Vatican and the Croatian fascists in Radio Free America program number 17, among others. We also have dealt with the Ustashi in numerous other broadcasts as well, the aforementioned Radio Free America program number 36 being among them, as well as some supplements to RFA 37. Skipping down in this article, we read, the Pope lavished praise on the late Cardinal Aloysius Stepanak, S-T-E-P-I-N-A-C. It's spelled here A-L-O-Y-S-I-U-S. I've also seen it spelled A-L-O-I-S. Perhaps both spellings are acceptable. If both are not, I do not know, frankly, which is correct. Spellings that I've seen in the past were A-L-O-I-S. This is A-L-O-Y-S-I-U-S. In any event, beginning again, the Pope lavished praise on the late Cardinal Aloysius Stepanak, S-T-E-P-I-N-A-C, leader of Croatian Catholics during World War II, and a symbol of unslaked hostility between Croats and Serbs. Croats cherished Stepanak as a patriot, and to repeated applause from the congregation, the Pope lauded him in the cathedral where he is buried as, quote, a true man of the church, ready for extreme sacrifice not to deny the faith, unquote. Serbs revile Stepanak, saying he and his priests condoned the massacre of tens of thousands of Serbs by Croatian fascists allied with Nazi occupiers during the war. Organizers of the papal visit said they expect as many as 500,000 Catholics at a mass on Sunday morning at Zagreb's racetrack after John Paul pays a courtesy call on Tudjman. The Pope returns to Rome on Sunday night, concluding his first foreign trip since a visit to the three Baltic republics a year ago. Well, in a supplement to Radio Free America number 36, we took a look at the Vatican's role in the destabilization of Eastern Europe during the Cold War, and it should be noted that although it is not mentioned in this particular article, Cardinal Stepanak was a member of the Ustashi Parliament during World War II. He was an official of that murderous government. He was tried and convicted as a war criminal after the conclusion of the war. So it is not just a subjective belief. He's not just viewed by the Serbs as someone who condoned the massacre of tens of thousands of Serbs. He was a member of the Ustashi Parliament. He was a member of a fascist government, and that is not mentioned in this article. And that's very telling omission, just like the telling omission in the American Heritage 1993 dictionary of the fact that fascism is a right-wing government is exemplary of the, what I feel, frankly, is the deliberate historical obfuscation of the true nature of fascism. The fact of the matter is, if one examines the truth about fascism, one comes across very, very powerful interests, powerful corporate interests, powerful financial interests, powerful intellectual interests, powerful religious interests that do not want their prestigious reputations sullied by the awareness of the fact that, in fact, they were pro-Hitler and pro-Mussolini and avidly, enthusiastically so. And again, I refer interested listeners to Radio Free America number 17, Fascism and the Vatican. By the way, newer listeners to the program will please bear with me. The archive shows are essential to, in my opinion, to a true understanding of the nature of, or to a true understanding of these broadcasts, I should say. Once again, if many of the things that I speak about seem incredible or outrageous, the documentation is there. That's why I've done the archive shows. That's why I've made them available from archives on audio. And frankly, I strongly recommend that people use them. It'll enhance your understanding, and it's a critical information source, a vital information source. I've gone to great length over the years to put those together. I don't make a dime from the sale of the tapes, much to my dismay. But that's FCC regs, folks, so that's the way it goes. Please, newer listeners in particular, get a hold of the archive shows. It'll enhance your understanding. Research credit on the following goes to Dave White, our pan-European translator and researcher. Dave gleaned this particular article from The Independent. That's a British newspaper out of London. Dave found this in The Independent of August 23rd of 1994. It concerns the renovation of the reputation of Ion Antonescu, the wartime fascist dictator of Romania. One thing that is not very widely known is that the fascist powers of World War II did not just involve Italy, Japan, and Germany, but also Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, independent quote-unquote Slovakia, independent quote-unquote Croatia, and for a time Finland as well. Romania, in World War II, was a very powerful ally of Adolf Hitler's and one of his most important allies in Eastern Europe. The fascist dictator of wartime Romania, Marshal Ion Antonescu, was the individual who presided over the brutal fascist government of Romania, installed by the Iron Guard, who were then submerged to a certain extent, although many of the Iron Guardists became principal operatives of the Antonescu fascist dictatorship. As is so often the case these days, the reputations of fascists are being dusted off, and renovated. And just as that article in the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle, in turn taken from the LA Times, failed to mention that Archbishop Stepanak was actually a member of the Ustashi Parliament. He was a member of a fascist government, just as the American Heritage Dictionary of 1993 neglected to mention that fascism is a right-wing political philosophy, a right-wing dictatorship. So the reputation of Ion Antonescu in Romania is being renovated, and now that brutal fascist is being dusted off and politically recreated as something of a hero by the Romanian people. Once again, research credit on this to Dave White. This article is entitled, once again, from The Independent, a British paper of August 23rd of 1994. This article is entitled, Romanians Cherish Memories of Their Genocidal Dictator, subheaded, Cult of the Wartime Pro-Nazi Leader Casts Doubt on Bucharest's Faith in Democracy, writes Tony Barber, East Europe editor. It reads in part as follows. In his lifetime, he was known as Hitler's favorite East European ally, a red-haired, syphilitic former cavalry officer who joined enthusiastically in the genocide of the Jews. But today, 50 years to the day after he was overthrown in a coup d'etat, Marshal Ion Antonescu is the object of a posthumous personality cult that is raising question marks over the quality of Romania's post-communist democracy. By the way, his name is capital A-N-T-O-N-E-S-C-U, first name capital I-O-N. Skipping down, Antonescu's rehabilitation has proceeded in leaps and bounds since 1989. Dozens of books have praised him as a military genius and a patriot. The Romanian Parliament stood in silence for 1 minute in 1991 to mark the 45th anniversary of his execution. A bust of Antonescu went up last year in the southern town of Slobozia, that's S-L-O-B-O-Z-I-A. At least eight other towns have named streets after him. One such town, Botosani, B-O-T-O-S-A-N-I, had a large pre-war Jewish population. Antonescu deported them for extermination. Almost 200,000 people have signed a petition calling for the retrial of Antonescu so that he can be posthumously acquitted of war crimes. Last New Year's Eve, Romanian television broadcast a program that mixed pictures of Antonescu's execution with pictures of King Michael receiving a Soviet award for his role in overthrowing the dictator. The program was inspired by the ultranationalist Greater Romania Party and was clearly intended to portray the king as a traitor who was in the pocket of the Kremlin. So, among the fascist elements that are undergoing a reputational facelift, to coin a term, the fascist dictator of wartime Romania, Ion Antonescu. Unfortunately, this is something of a pattern, and it's one of the reasons why Johnny and Janie can't identify Il Duce. Among the factors that I cited last week, in addition to historical obfuscation, journalistic obfuscation of the true nature of fascism has also had a great deal to do with why Johnny and Janie can't identify Il Duce, i.e. fascism, in the context that I'm using it here. Last week we spoke about the fascist collaborationist past of François Mitterrand, the current Prime Minister of France. The article that I referenced that from was from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, September 3rd of 1994. The New York Times of Friday, September 9th of 1994 had an article about the new book, and once again the title of the book is Une Jeunesse Française, A French Youth. The author is Pierre Payen, P-E accent aigu A-N, and this concerns the youth, quote-unquote, of François Mitterrand and his fascist collaborationist past. This particular article is entitled Mitterrand's, quote, mistakes, unquote, Vichy past is unveiled. It's subheaded Paris Journal. It's by Alan Ridding, or Alan Riding, R-I-D-I-N-G. It's datelined Paris, September 8th. Actually, before I read this, let's read the section from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, September 3rd of 1994, about François Mitterrand's association with the leaders of La Cagoule, that's spelled capital C-A-G-O-U-L-E, or the Hood. La Cagoule, or the Cagoule, or les Cagoulards, the so-called Hooded Ones, were a clandestine fascist organization which included very powerful members of the national security and political elite of France, as well as some of the most prominent industrialists, financiers, and aristocrats of France. It was a clandestine fascist organization whose members wore hoods to disguise their identity at meetings. They were organized along a cellular basis, basically. There were small clandestine groups. They were heavily armed. And above all else, most importantly, they worked directly with Third Reich and Italian intelligence in the pre-World War II period. The Cagoule conducted a terror program in 1936, 37, and 38, which aimed at overthrowing the democratic government of Léon Blum, his Popular Front. By the way, that's L-E-O-N, capital B-L-U-M. The Popular Front of Léon Blum was a democratically elected government with significant participation by socialists. It was basically an anti-fascist coalition whose members ran the political gamut from well-recognized and established centrists and liberals all the way over to doctrinaire communists on the left. The formation of the Popular Front was viewed with great alarm by powerful interests in France, who actively strove to overthrow it in the 36, 37, and 38 campaign. The campaign of the Cagoule was very similar to the 1934 coup attempt in the United States, in which industrialists and financiers, primarily those grouped around the House of Morgan, industrialists and financiers who were very sympathetic to Hitler and Mussolini, attempted to stage a military coup in the United States to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt, with whom they were very disenchanted, and replace the Roosevelt government with a fascist dictatorship. We dealt with that coup attempt in Radio Free America program number 10. Fortunately, the individual that was tabbed for the 34 coup attempt, former Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler, a true conservative, one should distinguish very sharply between a true conservative and a fascist. Smedley Butler was very critical of Franklin Roosevelt, but he was a true conservative and not a fascist. He was appalled at the suggestion that he helped to overthrow the legitimate constitutional authority, so he betrayed the coup. There was actually a congressional investigation by the McCormick-Dickstein Committee. Unfortunately, the 34 coup attempt in the United States is a lost element of history to a large extent. So, too, is the coup attempt, a more protracted coup attempt, that was undertaken by the Cagoule, or Les Cagoulards. Now, reading once again from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, September 3rd of 1994, an article by Marilyn August, spelled just like the month of the AP, Dateline Paris, headlined, "Veil Raised on Mitterrand's Tie to Wartime Nazi Collaborators." And skipping down in the article, we find, yes, Mitterrand had close ties with La Cagoule, an outlawed extreme-right group that sought to overthrow the Republic, and yes, he never repudiated his friendships with some of its leaders. That was just one of the many fascist connections of François Mitterrand that we looked at last week. Now, look at how very differently the New York Times portrays that same relationship. The New York Times describes François Mitterrand's relationship with the Cagoule as follows. Once again, New York Times, 9/9/94, column by, or an article by Alan Ridding or Alan Riding, Mitterrand's, quote, mistakes, unquote, Vichy past as unveiled, Paris, September 8th. Skipping down, we find, in a sense, though, because Mr. Mitterrand's pre-war rightism has long been discussed in whispers, the book serves him well because it demonstrates that he was never a member of either the violent rightist group known as La Cagoule or the Hood or the neo-fascist Action Française. Well, first of all, a correct way of expressing this particular historical element should have been there is no record, and assuming there is no record, of François Mitterrand ever having been a member of the group. It would be impossible, frankly, in 1994 to state without qualification, as this article does, that he was never a member of the Cagoule. The Cagoule didn't publish lists of its membership. It wasn't the goddamn Rotarians or the Lions Club. The Cagoule was a clandestine, murderous, fascist organization whose members wore hoods to prevent identification. I've no doubt that there is no record of François Mitterrand ever having been a member of the Cagoule, and he may very well have never actually been a member of the group. That's beside the point, however. The point is that he was very friendly with the leaders of this group, and they were absolutely murderous. They were collaborating with the German and Italian fascists, and many of its members helped to subvert the French military resistance to Hitler in 1940. They actively contributed to the subversion of the French military and the triumph of Hitler in 1940, and then went on to become prominent members of the Vichy fascist collaborationist government of Maréchal Pétain. It should be noted that François Mitterrand never repudiated his friendship with many of the leaders of this murderous organization. The New York Times portrayal of Mitterrand's relationship with La Cagoule would be rather like saying Mitterrand was never a member of the SS, whereas in fact Mitterrand was very cozy with people who were the French equivalent of the SS. If a German politician had been very friendly with Heinrich Himmler and his adjutant, General Karl Wolff, during World War II, that would be very, very alarming. The relationship between François Mitterrand, the friendship, never repudiated, between François Mitterrand and the leaders of La Cagoule, not to mention René Bousquet, B-O-U-S-Q-U-E-T, the head of the Vichy National Police, who rounded up Jews for deportation and extermination at Auschwitz, as well as helping to deep-sick the French resistance. The relationship between François Mitterrand and these fascist elements is very significant and very alarming. If, in fact, as I said, a German was very close to the leaders of the SS, that would be cause for alarm. And the fact that he never repudiated that relationship would be cause for even more alarm. And as I said, the article by the New York Times says that he was never a member of the Cagoule. And as I said before, I have no doubt that François Mitterrand, that there's no record of his having been a member of the Cagoule, and indeed he may not have actually been a member. I would note, however, that the Cagoule, once again, it was a clandestine fascist organization, not unlike the Ku Klux Klan from a methodological standpoint. Its members did not publish, they did not publicize the fact that they were members. And I think the statement that he was never a member is taking some rather profound liberties with history. But note, the fact that François Mitterrand was very close to the leaders of the Cagoule is not mentioned at all by the New York Times. The New York Times, although it has some excellent articles, was also the institution that published the Warren Report, and it was revealed in the Pike Committee hearings. The Pike Committee was a congressional committee, a House committee, looking into CIA misdeeds both at home and abroad. One of the things that came out during the context of the Pike Committee hearings was that the CIA actually considers the New York Times to be its number one propaganda asset. Basically, when the national security establishment wants to pitch a curve to the liberals, they send the New York Times to the mound, and generally, pretty consistently, the liberals and so-called progressive interests, as always note the use of the term so-called, strike out swinging on three pitches. And note, once again, the journalistic obfuscation of the true nature of fascism as presented here by America's paper of record, the New York Times. And that journalistic obfuscation is one of the main reasons why Johnny and Janie can't identify Il Duce. Last week we discussed French fascism, we discussed La Cagoule, we discussed the participation by members of La Cagoule in the fascist Vichy collaborationist government. We also examined the profound role played by French fascists, and Les Cagoulards in particular, in subverting the French military's resistance to Adolf Hitler. The French military, ostensibly at least, one of the most powerful in the world in 1940, succumbed in record time to the blitzkrieg of Adolf Hitler's armed forces. That defeat, the defeat of the French, was due to a combination of incompetence and deliberate subversion. One of the things that we looked at last week was the fact that many prominent people in France, many members, for example, of the so-called 200 families who owned France, not to mention powerful French reactionary politicians and military people, actually preferred the prospect of German fascists occupying their country to the prospect of cohabiting with the center-left coalition of Léon Blum and the Popular Front. The defeat of the French in 1940 was due to a combination of what was no doubt sincere incompetence. It was also due to the deliberate subversion of the French military by some of the military people who were far more sympathetic to the fascism of Hitler and Mussolini than they were to the center-left democracy of the Popular Front under Léon Blum. To further understand the nature of the French defeat in 1940, by the way, I would note, by way of examining our contemporary historical understanding, that as I speak on the evening of September 11th, 1994, we're approximately 3 months from the 50th anniversary of the Normandy invasion. That invasion, of course, freed France from a fascist dictatorship, from fascist occupation by the Germans. What has not been properly recorded, however, by history is how the Germans wound up in possession of France in the first place, and the role of the Cagoulards in their fascist subversive attempts of 36 through 38, as well as the role of individuals associated with La Cagoule, as well as the Croix de Fer, another French fascist organization, in deliberately subverting the French resistance to Hitler in 1940. That has not been properly recorded by history. Those members of the audience who are students of history and political science should study well the information presented last week, as well as the information that I'm going to present this week. It is an historical footnote to the observation of the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of D-Day that is not going to achieve the recognition it deserves. I would also note that France, under François Mitterrand, has been very close to Germany, and the now newly reunited Germany, with resurgent fascism busting out all over, so to speak, is actually merging its armed forces with those of France. We took a look in our June 12th broadcast, part of the Seeds of Nuremberg miscellaneous archive series, at the merging of the French and German navies. There's already the so-called Euro Corps, a joint French-German military unit. This past July, on Bastille Day, the French national holiday, German Panzers, German armored units, actually participated in the parade down the Champs-Élysées for the first time since the Nazi occupation of Paris. It is interesting to observe François Mitterrand presiding over the Panzer participation, so to speak, in Bastille Day, as well as the merging of the French and German navies. I would note that François Mitterrand's conversion to becoming a résistant, or an anti-fascist, took place in 1943, and it was in 1943, as we saw in Radio Free America number 37, specifically in the August 9th, 1994 installment of Radio Free America 37, How the U.S. Lost the Second World War, as well as the September 20th, 1994 installment of How the U.S. Lost the Second World War. In those two programs, we took a look at the fact that the Nazis began their formal plans to go underground. They actually began putting together their cellularly organized underground structure in 1943, specifically in May of 1943, after the German defeat at Stalingrad during World War II. It was in that time period, in 1943, beginning in May, that the German Nazi Party began putting together its clandestine organization to survive military defeat. And among the possibilities that I think needs to be very seriously considered with regard to François Mitterrand is that perhaps, his joining the resistance was part of that going underground of fascism. It may just be coincidence that he decided to switch sides in 1943, and I fully acknowledge that possibility for the record. On the other hand, it also needs to be very serious that the possibility that François Mitterrand may have all along been a clandestine fascist also needs to be very seriously considered. What we're going to do next is take a look at the subversion of France from a military standpoint. Once again, I want to state that the catastrophic nature, the sudden collapse of the French military was due to a combination of what was no doubt sincere incompetence by reactionary French officers and also deliberate subversion by some of the same fellow travelers of La Cagoule and actual leaders of La Cagoule who much preferred to see Adolf Hitler in possession of France than Léon Blum. We're going to turn for an examination of the performance of the French Air Force prior to and during the early stages of World War II. We're going to turn for our analysis and discussion to a book that we utilized heavily last week. That book is entitled The Triumph of Treason. Its author is Pierre Cot, last name C-O-T. This book was published in hardcover in 1944, 50 years ago, by Ziff, Ziff-Davis, Ziff hyphen Davis, of Chicago and New York. Now, Pierre Coe was the French Minister of Aviation under the Popular Front of Léon Blum, that center-left coalition government that was the object of so much hatred on the part of La Cagoule, the Croix de Fer, and the French fascists who made up the collaborationist government of Maréchal Pétain, and with whom François Mitterrand was very, very cozy. An audience listening in 1994 may find many aspects of what I'm about to say strange, because we have become in 1994 quite accustomed to the tactics of the military tactics of modern air forces, in particular the use of modern air forces against ground forces, the use of modern air forces as tactical elements against armored columns. We should note that in the pre-World War II period, many of these established military doctrines were not established at all. Now, part of the background that one should understand in order to grasp the discussion that I'm about to present is that Pierre Coe, the French Minister of Aviation under Léon Blum and the Popular Front, sought to reorganize not only the organizational structure but the tactical disposition of the French Air Force along the lines that the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, had already been reorganized along. The most powerful elements in the French military, as well as the political structure, were opposed to Pierre Coe. But Pierre Coe, who, by the way, wrote a book called L'Armée de l'Air, The Army of the Air in English, sought to reorganize the French Air Force. In particular, he wanted to put together what he refers to here as an attacking air force, an air force which would be deployed in great force against some of the lead armor units of a potential attacking enemy, in this case, obviously, the most serious potential attacker and the eventual real attacker of France was Nazi Germany. One of the things that Pierre Coe sought to do was to put together a modern attack air force which could be deployed in strength against some of the leading motorized units of an attacking enemy. Obviously, such an organization and such a disposition is absolutely consistent with not only the tactics that we have come to be familiar with in the half century that has elapsed since this book was written, but the basic tactical and organizational disposition that Pierre Coe was proposing for the French Air Force was the same tactical organization and disposition that the German Air Force had already employed. And we should note that the tactics of the German Air Force were tried out with great success during the Spanish Civil War, when Franco's fascists were greatly aided by the Condor Legion. That was a Luftwaffe contingent that played a prominent role on behalf of Franco's victorious fascist forces in the French in the Spanish Civil War. We're going to take a look now at how a combination of sincere incompetence and what appears to be deliberate subversion, deliberate refutation of the tactics proposed by Pierre Coe led to the defeat of the tactics proposed by Pierre Coe. That, in turn, helped to contribute massively to the French defeat. And even Pierre Coe himself notes that some of the people who were resistant to his proposed changes were simply sincere incompetence. Also, however, we should note that some of the French military figures who led to the refutation of the modernization doctrine espoused by Pierre Coe were very, very close to the Cagoulard and the individuals who went on to become very prominent with the fascist collaborationist government of Vichy and Maréchal Pétain. In a section of Triumph of Treason called The Doctrine of Air Warfare, Pierre Coe writes as follows. The doctrine of aerial warfare merely applied Pétain's general conception to the field of aviation. He had been Inspector General of Aerial Defense from 1931 until 1934, and had developed an entirely false notion of the possibilities, the dangers, and consequently the function of modern aviation. He believed that aviation ought to play a triple role. One, at the outbreak of hostilities, to stage large-scale raids on the interior of enemy countries to paralyze their mobilization and break civilian morale. Two, during the war, to serve primarily in small units as auxiliary arms to infantry units. And three, to participate indirectly in land warfare by bombardments outside and behind the battlefields to extend, but not replace, artillery action. Now, of course, staging large-scale raids on the interior of enemy countries is consistent with modern military aviation doctrine. We've seen that in numerous wars since this book was written. I would note, however, that the other principles here espoused by Maréchal Pétain are, of course, completely inconsistent with modern military doctrine as it applies to air power. Again, of Maréchal Pétain's view of air power, quote, "He believed that aviation ought to play a triple role. One, at the outbreak of hostilities to stage large-scale raids on the interior of enemy countries to paralyze their mobilization and break civilian morale. Two, during the war to serve primarily in small units as auxiliary arms to infantry units. And three, to participate indirectly in land warfare by bombardments outside and behind the battlefields to extend but not replace artillery action." These ideas were not original. They had been given to Maréchal Pétain by his usual advisors on aviation matters, Colonel Vautier, General Dusigneur, a Cagoulard leader, General Vatieu, later a judge at the court of Rion. By the way, the Rion trial, spelled R-I-O-M, were trials of many of the political leaders of the Popular Front, which attributed the French defeat in World War II to mistakes made by the government of Léon Blum, not to mistakes made and deliberate subversion by those opposed to Léon Blum, which was in fact the case. By the way, the spellings here, Vautier, V-A-U-T-H-I-E-R, Dusigneur, D-U-S-S-E-I-G-N-E-U-R, Vatieu, W-A-T-T-E-A-U, and General, we're going to continue here. Resuming again, the other name here is General Pujol, P-U-J-O, or Pujol, perhaps, since this is French, not Spanish. Beginning again, "These ideas were not original. They had been given to Maréchal Pétain by his usual advisors on aviation matters, Colonel Vautier, General Dusigneur, a Cagoulard leader, General Vatieu, later a judge at the court of Rion, and General Pujol, Minister of Aviation in the Pétain cabinet after the armistice. Of these men, Pujol was the most intelligent. Profoundly reactionary by education and temperament, he was quite timorous but had a refined and honest mind. Unfortunately, his entire career had been centered on aviation as a supporting arm for the other forces, a prejudice strengthened by his friendship for Pétain." Skipping down, "The Popular Front attempted to get out of that rut. Under a General Fécamp, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, a new organization of the Air Force was created. Experiments in dive bombing and with attacking air forces were made, new ideas were put into circulation, and the Pujol-Pétain doctrine was abandoned. Modern and, oh, by the way, General Fécamp, F-E-X-Q-U-A-N-T, continuing. "Modern and progressive in his thinking, Fécamp surrounded himself with a group of enthusiastic young officers determined to create a modern air force. On the intellectual plane, the reorganization began in September of 1936, with an article in the Revue de l'Armée de l'Air by Engineer-in-Chief C. Rougeron, entitled "Low-Altitude Bombing," unquote. Rougeron, R-O-U-G-E-R-O-N. This article discussed the intervention of the airplane in land warfare and opposed the classic doctrine. Shortly afterwards came the creation of the School of Aerial Warfare and the Center of Advanced Aerial Studies for the study of tactical problems introduced by the use of aviation. In March of 1937, Rougeron published a second article, "L'aviation et les chars de combat," again in the Revue, in which he explained the direct use of the airplane in land warfare. He recalled the theories developed abroad, chiefly by the Italians, as well as the experiments of the Russians, and developed the ideas which inspired the new general staff group, ironically called the Brain Trust, of the aviation ministry. Quote, "The intervention of the airplane in mechanized war," wrote Rougeron, "will completely change the conception which we have of it today. The airplane is the best anti-tank weapon," unquote. That last sentence in many ways exemplifies or states quite succinctly the tactical differences and the organizational differences between the reactionaries and the fascists of the Pétain school and the individuals, the people in the aviation ministry under Piaquot and Léon Blum. Obviously, as we sit from the vantage point of 1994, the airplane is indeed a superb anti-tank weapon, and that has been proved over and over in modern warfare. This was not such a well-known concept in this time period, however, And we should note that the proposal to reorganize and deploy the French Air Force in this capacity was rejected when the Popular Front of Léon Blum was voted out of power. Once again, resuming this last sentence, quote, "The intervention of the airplane in mechanized war," unquote, wrote Rougeron, "will completely change the conception which we have of it today. The airplane is the best anti-tank weapon," unquote. In February of 1937, while explaining my views on the use of aviation to the Chamber of Deputies, I had declared myself in favor of the concentration of aerial forces as opposed to the dispersal and assignment of aerial units to army units. Quote, "We want to be ready," I said, "either to throw ourselves into land fighting with all our forces, or to cooperate with the Navy with all our forces, or, if necessary, to fight the air war with all our forces. We are concentrating on the use of parachutists, dive bombing, and low-altitude bombing, which permit us to attack enemy columns with lightly armored aircraft in the expectation of paralyzing the advance of motorized units." Unquote. Obviously, such a use of air forces is consistent with the modern tactics that we've all become accustomed to and would have been very effective in helping to neutralize Hitler's blitzkrieg. As we'll see, it was rejected. Continuing, on December 11, 1937, I again explained the general broad rules, the need to increase the importance of aviation in national defense, particularly the development of heavy bombers, and the need to create an offensive air force capable of attacking armored units. This doctrine was approved by a large majority. Only the most reactionary elements of Parliament did not concur. The leaders of national defense, however, preferred to follow Maréchal Pétain's theories, and the new doctrine was abandoned when I left the Air Ministry in January of 1938. With the dissolution of the Popular Front, General Fécamp and his principal collaborators were removed in disgrace. Their error had been to believe with Napoleon that, quote, "one must know how to change tactics every 10 years, unquote. A more conformist chief of staff, General Villemin, V-U-I-L-L-E-M-I-N, was appointed, and in spite of the resistance of the Aeronautic Commission of the Chamber of Deputies, the Air Force returned to its old ideas. The classic doctrine of Peugeot and Pétain triumphed again. We should note here again that some of the people who were in favor of reversing the policies espoused by Pierre Coe and the other principals of French aviation on the Popular Front, doctrines which would have enabled the French Air Force to participate much more effectively in resisting Hitler's Panzer divisions, many of those people were sincere, if perhaps inept, conservatives, but note also that some of them were leaders of the Cagoulard. We should note also that there were many actions by the French military in World War II prior to Hitler's triumph in June of 1940 that are difficult to accept as incompetence. Unfortunately, due to the limitations of time this evening, we cannot go into the functioning of the French military during the German invasion of 1940 to the extent that we perhaps should, or certainly that I would like to. But suffice it to say again that the remarkable quickness with which the French were defeated was due to a combination of incompetence and also deliberate subversion, and the extent to which the subversion of viable French air doctrine was due to incompetence and the extent to which it was due to deliberate subversion is open to debate and to further historical examination.